The Balfour Declaration, Part 1. Section 1. The World on the Brink, 1914-1915. The Sound of the Old World Dying. To understand the Balfour Declaration, one must first hear the world as it sounded in 1914. It was a world of steam whistles, the clatter of horse-drawn hansoms on London cobblestones, and the rustle of heavy broadsheet newspapers that carried the news of an Archduke's assassination in Sarajevo. For the British elite, the Middle East was not a place of modern nations, but a romantic, dusty extension of the Sunday school lessons they had learned as children. It was the Orient, a land of ancient ruins and strategic harbors. When the Ottoman Empire entered the war on the side of the Kaiser in October 1914, it wasn't just a military development, it was a spiritual and geopolitical earthquake. The British Empire had spent the better part of a century as the protector of the Ottomans. They had fought the Crimean War to keep the Turks in power because the sick man of Europe, however weak, was a better neighbor than a Russian Empire that hungered for the warm waters of the Mediterranean. But the moment the Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed V, declared a jihad against the Triple Entente, the British policy of preservation was replaced by a policy of partition. The question was no longer how to save the Ottoman Empire, but how to carve it up in a way that ensured British supremacy for the next 100 years. The strategic anxiety of the Admiralty. In the white stone halls of the Admiralty, a young, restless Winston Churchill was obsessed with the map. He looked at the Suez Canal, a thin, blue ribbon of water cutting through the desert, and saw the jugular vein of the British Empire. Through that canal flowed the troops from Australia, the wheat from India, and the oil from the newly discovered fields in Persia. If the Turks, guided by German officers, could bridge the Sinai and seize the canal, the British Empire would be decapitated. This fear was not irrational. In February 1915, the Ottomans actually launched a daring raid across the desert with thousands of men and galvanized iron pontoons, attempting to cross the canal. Though the British repelled them, the message was clear. The desert was no longer a shield. Britain needed a permanent, friendly garrison on the eastern side of the canal. They needed Palestine. Section 2, Chaim Weizmann and the Chemistry of Influence. The Laboratory in Manchester. While Churchill was moving ships on a map, a man named Chaim Weizmann was moving bacteria in a petri dish. Weizmann is the indispensable character of this story. Born in the village of Motul in the Russian Empire, he was one of 15 children. He was a man of the Pale of Settlement, the restricted territory where Jews were forced to live under the Tsar. He had seen the pogroms, he had felt the weight of being a man without a country. By 1915, Weizmann was a professor of chemistry at the University of Manchester. He was a brilliant scientist, but he was an even more brilliant psychologist. He understood the British better than they understood themselves. He realized that the British aristocracy was a strange blend of cold imperial calculation and deep, Protestant religious romanticism. To win them over, he would have to speak to both. The Acetone Crisis. The war was not just a battle of men, it was a battle of industrial output. By 1915, the British were facing a catastrophic shell crisis. They were running out of gunpowder. Specifically, they were running out of acetone, the solvent needed to produce cordite. Without it, the British Navy's big guns would be silent. Traditionally, acetone was made from wood, and Britain was running out of trees. Weizmann discovered a process of synthetic fermentation. Using a bacterium called Clostridium acetobutylicum, he could turn ordinary maize or horse chestnuts into high-grade acetone. He brought this discovery to C.P. Scott, the editor of the Manchester Guardian, who in turn introduced him to David Lloyd George, then the Minister of Munitions. When Lloyd George asked what the British government could do for him in exchange for this war-winning discovery, Weizmann didn't ask for a knighthood or a fortune. He said, "I want to talk to you about my people." This chemical diplomacy gave Weizmann a status that no other Zionist leader had. He wasn't just a petitioner, he was a savior of the Royal Navy. Section 3, The Secret Partition, The Sykes-Picot Ghost. A line in the sand. In early 1916, while the carnage of Verdun was unfolding in France, Two men sat in a room in London with a map and a grease pencil. Sir Mark Sykes represented Britain, and François Georges Picot represented France. Sykes was a man of immense energy and terrible attention to detail. He was a traveller politician who believed he understood the Arab mind. Picot was a classic French colonialist, determined to ensure that France emerged from the war with a greater Syria. They drew a line, the AB line, that stretched from the E in Acre to the K in Kirkuk. Everything north was French, everything south was British. But Palestine was a problem. It was the Holy Land. The Russians wanted a say because of the Orthodox Church, the French wanted it because of their historical role as protectors of the Catholics, the British wanted it because of the Suez Canal. To solve the deadlock, they decided on an international administration. It was a messy compromise that satisfied no one. When Sykes later met Chaim Weizmann, Weizmann was horrified. He told Sykes that an international Palestine would be a land of constant friction and chaos. He told Sykes that the British should take it all, with the Zionists as their partners. The conversion of Mark Sykes. This is a pivotal moment. Sykes, the man who had helped design the secret deal to split the Middle East, became a convert to Zionism. He didn't do it out of religious love for the Jewish people. He did it because he realized that the Sykes-Picot agreement was a trap for Britain. If Britain backed a Jewish national home, they would have a moral reason to tear up the secret deal with the French and keep Palestine for themselves. Sykes became the bridge between Weizmann and the British Foreign Office. He began to introduce Weizmann to the inner circle of the British government, framing Zionism not as a refugee movement, but as the ultimate imperial tool. The Balfour Declaration, Part 2. Section 4, The 1917 Pivot, A New Government and a New Desperation. The Fall of Asquith and the Rise of the Welsh Wizard. To understand why 1917 was the year of the Declaration, we have to look at the political coup that occurred in London in December 1916. For the first 2 years of the war, Britain was led by H.H. Asquith, a man of high intellect but profound caution. His motto was wait and see. But by late 1916, the British public and the press were tired of waiting. The Somme had been a bloodbath, the Russian front was wobbling, and the treasury was nearly empty. In a swift, backroom maneuver, Asquith was ousted. The man who replaced him was David Lloyd George. If Asquith was a cool glass of water, Lloyd George was a lightning storm. He was a man of immense energy who replaced the large, rambling cabinet with a tiny, five-man war cabinet. This group, Lloyd George, Lord Curzon, Lord Milner, Bona Law, and Arthur Henderson, held total, dictatorial power over the British war effort. Lloyd George brought with him a new philosophy, the knockout blow. He believed that the war in the West was a stalemate of mud and wire that could only be won by a brilliant maneuver in the East. He looked at the map of the Ottoman Empire and saw the soft underbelly of the Central Powers. He famously told General Allenby, the man he sent to take command in Egypt, that he wanted Jerusalem by Christmas. The psychological state of Arthur James Balfour. While Lloyd George was the motor, Arthur James Balfour was the architect. Balfour had recently moved from the Admiralty to become the Foreign Secretary. To the outside observer, Balfour was the ultimate English Sphinx. He was a wealthy bachelor, a philosopher who wrote books on theism and humanism, and a man so detached that he supposedly didn't know how to use a telephone. But Balfour had a deep, almost mystical obsession with the Jewish question. This dated back to 1906, when he had first met Chaim Weizmann in a hotel room in Manchester. At the time, Balfour was a defeated prime minister, and Weizmann was a young chemist. Balfour had asked Weizmann why the Zionists were so opposed to the British offer of a territory in Uganda. Weizmann had looked at Balfour and asked, "Mr. Balfour, if I were to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it?" Balfour replied, "But we already have London." Weizmann countered, "And we had Jerusalem when London was still a marsh." That encounter stayed with Balfour for a decade. By 1917, he saw a chance to correct what he viewed as a world historical wrong. He believed that Western civilization owed the Jewish people a debt for the centuries of persecution they had endured in Europe. But being a British imperialist, he also saw that this debt could be paid with someone else's land, land that Britain happened to need for its own survival. Section 5. The Great Myth and the Russian Collapse. The Ghost of International Influence. One of the most powerful, and often ignored, drivers of the Balfour Declaration was a deep-seated prejudice within the British Foreign Office. Many of the men in power, Balfour, Mark Sykes, and Robert Cecil, held a skewed view of Jewish power. They believed in a monolithic Jewish influence that spanned the globe. They looked at the United States and saw a president, Woodrow Wilson, who was surrounded by Jewish advisers like Louis Brandeis and Bernard Baruch. They looked at Russia and saw a revolutionary movement where many of the leaders were of Jewish descent. In their minds, the Jews were a secret lever that could move the world. They wrongly assumed that if they made a pro-Zionist declaration, the Jewish community in Russia would rise up, stop the Bolshevik Revolution, and keep Russia in the war. Simultaneously, they believed that Jewish influence in America would force the US to accelerate its troop shipments to France. This was a delusion. The Jewish community was as divided as any other, but it was a delusion that Chaim Weizmann played with the skill of a virtuoso. He didn't invent these prejudices, but he certainly didn't correct them when they served his cause. He allowed the British to believe that backing Zionism was a war-winning move. The race against Berlin. In the summer of 1917, a new fear gripped the Foreign Office, the fear that Germany was about to beat them to the punch. Intelligence reports suggested that the German government was meeting with Zionist leaders in Berlin. The Germans, too, were beginning to see the strategic value of a Jewish national home in the Middle East as a way to undermine British and Russian influence. Balfour became convinced that this was a race. He believed that if Germany issued a declaration first, the loyalty of the Jewish world would be lost to the Central Powers forever. This sense of urgency is what finally pushed the declaration out of the realm of someday and into the realm of now. Section 6. The Internal Jewish Civil War, the Montague Crisis. The dissenter in the cabinet. Just as the path seemed clear, the cabinet was blindsided by one of its own. Edwin Montague was the Secretary of State for India, a brilliant administrator, and a man of Jewish faith. He was also the most vocal and articulate enemy the Balfour Declaration ever had. Montague's opposition was not based on geography or strategy, it was based on identity. He considered himself a British citizen of the Jewish persuasion. He loathed the idea of Zionism because he believed it validated the claims of anti-Semites. He argued that if Britain declared that the Jewish home was in Palestine, then every Jew in London or Paris would be seen as a foreigner or an alien. In August 1917, Montague submitted a scathing, 10-page memorandum to the cabinet entitled The Antisemitism of the Present Government. It was a bombshell. He wrote, "I wish to place on record my view that the policy of His Majesty's government is antisemitic and in result will prove a rallying ground for anti-Semites in every country in the world." The delay and the compromise. Montague's memo brought the process to a grinding halt. The non-Jewish members of the cabinet, Balfour and Lloyd George, were stunned. They had expected the Jewish community to be universally grateful. Now, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the empire was calling them anti-Semites. This led to a period of intense textual warfare. Between August and October 1917, the draft of the declaration went through 5 major revisions. Every word was fought over. Montague insisted that the document must protect the status of Jews in other countries. He also insisted that it must mention the rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. This is why the final declaration is so strangely worded. It is a document of doublespeak. It promises a national home to the Zionists, while simultaneously promising the Arabs that their rights won't be harmed, and promising the assimilated Jews that their status in Europe won't be changed. It was a legal impossibility, but it was the only way to get the document through the cabinet. Section 7. The Final Countdown, or October 1917. The War Cabinet's Last Stand. By October, The global situation was desperate. The Italian army had been shattered at the Battle of Caporetto. The Bolsheviks were days away from seizing the Winter Palace in Petrograd. The British needed a win, any win. On October 31, 1917, the War Cabinet met at 10, Downing Street. The room was thick with the smoke of cigars and the weight of the war. Balfour stood up and made his final case. He told the cabinet that the German Zionist threat was real. He told them that the Americans were waiting for a lead. But most importantly, he framed the declaration as a matter of national honor. He argued that the British Empire had always been the protector of the oppressed, and that by restoring the Jewish people to their ancestral home, Britain would be fulfilling its destiny as the new Rome. The cabinet voted. There was no grand fanfare. No trumpets sounded. In the minutes of the meeting, it was recorded as just another item of business, squeezed between discussions on coal rations and shipping tonnages. The ayes had it. The signature 2 days later, on November 2, 1917, Arthur Balfour sat at his desk at the Foreign Office. He took a sheet of stationery and typed out the letter to Lord Walter Rothschild. He didn't address it to the Zionist organization, he addressed it to a peer of the realm, a Rothschild, to give it an air of aristocratic legitimacy. He signed it, "Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour." He then handed the letter to a messenger. At that moment, the British didn't even own Palestine. Their armies were still fighting in the dust of the Gaza trenches. They were promising a land they did not yet possess, to a people who did not yet live there, while ignoring the people who had lived there for 1,000 years. Section 8. The immediate fallout, the double promise. The Arab reaction and the T.E. Lawrence factor. While the Zionists in London were celebrating, the news began to trickle down to the Middle East. And here we meet the ghost at the table, the Arab people. For 2 years, the British had been funding the Arab revolt. They had sent gold, guns, and a charismatic, eccentric intelligence officer named T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, to lead the Bedouin tribes against the Turks. The Arabs had been promised an independent kingdom. They believed Palestine was part of that kingdom. When the Balfour Declaration was published, the Arab leadership felt a cold chill of betrayal. They realized that while they were blowing up Turkish trains and dying in the desert for British interests, the British were selling their land to a third party. Lawrence himself was caught in the middle. He knew about the Balfour Declaration and the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement. He felt a profound sense of shame, writing later that he had urged the Arabs on knowing that the promises made to them were dead paper. This was the beginning of the double promise, the original sin of British policy in the Middle East that would lead to a century of bloodshed. The Balfour Declaration, Part 3. Section 9. The Landscape of the Promised Land, 1917. The Physical Reality of Palestine. Before we continue with the political intrigue in London, we must transport ourselves to the physical space that Balfour was so casually signed away. In 1917, Palestine was not a desert wasteland, nor was it a modern state. It was a province of the Ottoman Empire, divided into administrative districts known as sanjaks. To the British soldier marching north from Egypt, the landscape was a brutal trial. It began with the Sinai, a shifting, white-gold expanse of sand that reflected the sun with a blinding intensity. Water was the only currency that mattered. The British had to build a literal pipeline from the Nile River, dragging the water of Egypt across the desert just to keep their horses alive. As you moved north into Palestine, the landscape changed into the rolling, limestone hills of Judea. These hills were terraced with ancient olive groves, some of which had stood since the time of the Romans. The air smelled of wild thyme, dust, and wood smoke. To the east lay the Jordan Valley, a deep, humid trench that sits lower than any other place on earth, dominated by the salt-heavy expanse of the Dead Sea. The people of the land. Who lived there while Balfour was typing his letter? The population was roughly 700,000 people. About 80% were Muslim Arabs, living in stone-built villages like Nablus, Hebron, and Gaza. They were farmers, traders, and scholars. There was also a significant Christian Arab population, particularly in Bethlehem and Jerusalem, who acted as the cultural bridge between the East and the West. Then there was the Jewish population, about 10-12% of the total. This was divided into two groups. The Old Yishuv were religious Jews who had lived in the four holy cities, Jerusalem, Seft, Tiberias, and Hebron, for centuries, supported by charity from Europe. But since the 1880s, a new group had arrived, the Zionist pioneers. These were young, secular Jews from Russia and Poland who were building the first kibbutzim, collective farms like Degania on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. When Balfour wrote his letter, he was intervening in a complex, delicate ecosystem of people who had lived in a state of uncomfortable peace for generations. He was about to tip the scales. Section 10. Deep Biography, Lord Walter Rothschild. The man who received the letter. We must look at the man to whom the letter was actually addressed, Lionel Walter Rothschild, the second Baron Rothschild. Why him? Why not the Zionist organization? Walter Rothschild was a fascinating, eccentric figure. He was the scion of the greatest banking dynasty in the world, but he had no interest in banking. He was a zoologist. He kept zebras in his garden and famously drove a carriage pulled by 6 zebras through the streets of London to prove they could be tamed. He collected over 2 million butterflies and hundreds of giant tortoises. But as a Rothschild, he was also the lay leader of British Jewry. The British government chose him as the recipient because they wanted to give the declaration the stamp of the establishment. They wanted the world to see that the wealthiest, most powerful Jewish family on earth was behind this project. However, Walter was a shy, stuttering man who was often overwhelmed by the political giants like Weizmann. By addressing the letter to Rothschild, Balfour was signaling that this wasn't just a deal with a political movement, it was a pact with the Jewish nobility. Section 11. The Global Stakeholders, the French and the Vatican. The French resentment. While the British were celebrating, the French were fuming. François-Georges Picot, the man who had signed the secret partition deal, felt he had been cheated. The French saw the Balfour Declaration for exactly what it was, a British attempt to claim moral suzerainty over Palestine. The French had deep historical ties to the Levant. Since the time of the Crusades, they had viewed themselves as the protectors of the Latin Christians in the East. They wanted a greater Syria that included Jerusalem. When they saw the British backing the Zionists, they realized that Britain was building a human wall of Jewish settlers between the French sphere and the Suez Canal. This led to a period of intense diplomatic sabotage. The French began to support Arab nationalists in secret, hoping to make Palestine so unstable that the British would be forced to leave. The rivalry between the British and French allies in 1917 was often more bitter than their rivalry with the Germans. The Vatican's anxiety. We cannot forget the Pope. In 1917, Pope Benedict XV sat in the Vatican, watching the British, a Protestant power, and the Zionists, a Jewish movement, prepare to take control of the Holy City of Jerusalem. For the Catholic Church, the idea of the holy places falling into non-Christian hands was a theological crisis. The Vatican feared that the Zionists would take over the shrines, or that the British would secularize the Holy Land. To appease the Pope, the British had to make elaborate promises that the status quo of the holy sites would be maintained. This added another layer of complexity to Balfour's 6-7 words. They now had to satisfy the Zionists, the Arabs, the French, and the Catholic Church. Section 12. The Double Promise and the McMahon Paradox. The Cairo Intelligence Office. To truly understand the betrayal narrative, we have to go inside the Savoy Hotel in Cairo, the headquarters of British intelligence in the Middle East. Here, men like Gilbert Clayton and Ronald Storrs were managing the Arab Bureau. In 1915, they had authorized Sir Henry McMahon to write a series of 10 letters to Husayn bin Ali, the Sharif of Mecca. These letters are known as the McMahon-Husayn correspondence. McMahon wrote, "Great Britain is prepared to recognize and support the independence of the Arabs in all the regions within the limits demanded by the Sharif of Mecca." The Arabs understood this to include Palestine. The British later argued that Palestine was excluded because it lay west of the districts of Damascus, Homs, Hama, and Aleppo. But if you look at a map, Palestine is south of those districts, not west. This wasn't a mistake. It was deliberate constructive ambiguity. The British wanted the Arabs to fight for them now, and they figured they would deal with the overlapping promises later. The T.E. Lawrence crisis. No discussion of this period is complete without Thomas Edward Lawrence. Lawrence was a young archaeologist who had become the liaison to the Arab revolt. He lived with the Arabs, wore their clothes, and led them in guerrilla warfare against the Turks. Lawrence was a true believer in Arab independence. But he was also a British officer. He knew about the Balfour Declaration. He knew about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. He spent the year of 1917 in a state of profound psychological torture. He wrote in his memoirs, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, "I was sent to these people as a harlot. I was perfectly aware that the British promises were dead paper. Had I been an honorable advisor, I would have sent my men home and not let them risk their lives for such a cause." Lawrence's guilt is the human embodiment of the Balfour Declaration's fallout. While the diplomats in London were playing imperial chess, the men on the ground were realizing that they were the pawns. The Balfour Declaration, Part 4. Section 13, The Road to Jerusalem, General Allenby's Crusade. The Changing of the Guard. While the pens were moving in London, the boots were moving in the Sinai. For the first 2 years of the war, the British campaign against the Turks in Egypt had been a stagnant, embarrassing failure. Two attempts to break the Turkish line at Gaza had ended in disaster. The British commander, General Archibald Murray, was seen as too cautious, too distant. In June 1917, David Lloyd George decided he needed a man of action. He summoned General Edmund Allenby from the Western Front. Allenby was a massive, physically imposing man nicknamed the Bull. Lloyd George gave him a simple, direct order: "I want Jerusalem by Christmas." The Third Battle of Gaza and the Beersheba Gambit. Allenby arrived in Egypt and immediately moved his headquarters from a luxury hotel in Cairo to the front lines in the desert. He realized that the Turks expected another frontal assault on Gaza. Instead, Allenby decided on a daring flank maneuver through the desert to the ancient town of Beersheba. Beersheba was the key to the entire Turkish defensive line because of its ancient wells. On October 31, 1917, the exact same day the War Cabinet in London was voting to approve the Balfour Declaration, the Australian Light Horse launched one of the last great cavalry charges in history. They galloped across open ground under heavy fire, jumped the Turkish trenches, and captured the wells of Beersheba before the Turks could blow them up. This victory broke the back of the Ottoman defense. As the British soldiers drank the cool water of Beersheba, they had no idea that at that very moment, Arthur Balfour was preparing to sign the letter that would define the land they were about to occupy. Section 14, December 1917, The Surrender of the Holy City. The Fog of War and the Mayor's White Flag. By December, Allenby's forces had fought their way into the Judean hills. On December 9, 1917, the Ottoman governor and his troops fled Jerusalem. The mayor of Jerusalem, Hussein al-Husseini, walked out of the city gates with a white sheet tied to a broomstick. He tried to surrender the city to two British mess cooks who had gotten lost looking for eggs. Then he tried to surrender to a group of British sergeants. Finally, he found a British general. Jerusalem, the city that had been under Muslim rule for nearly 500 years, was now in British hands. The entry of the Bull. David Lloyd George wanted a grand entrance, but Allenby was a man of surprising sensitivity. On December 11, 1917, he entered the Jaffa Gate. But he didn't enter on a horse, and he didn't enter with a parade. He dismounted and walked into the city on foot. He said he did this out of respect for the holy city and because the Son of Man had entered on a donkey and on foot. It was a masterpiece of propaganda. To the British public, this was the end of the Crusades. The Punch magazine published a famous cartoon showing Richard the Lionheart looking down at Jerusalem and saying, "My dream comes true." But for the Zionists and the Arabs, this entrance was the physical manifestation of the Balfour Declaration. The British were no longer just promising the land, they were standing in it. Section 15, The Global Stakeholders, The Reaction in the United States. The Zionist Secret Service in America. We have to look at the United States, because the Balfour Declaration was, in many ways, an American project. In 1917, the U.S. was the new world power. President Woodrow Wilson was a man of high-minded ideals, but he was also a politician who needed to maintain the support of his constituency. Inside Wilson's inner circle was Louis Brandeis. Brandeis was the first Jewish Supreme Court justice and a leader of the American Zionist movement. He was the one who translated the Balfour Declaration into American values. He told Wilson that Zionism was about self-determination, the very thing Wilson was preaching for the rest of Europe. The American Jewish Committee tension. But just like in England, the American Jewish community was not a monolith. The wealthy uptown Jews, many of German descent, were terrified of the declaration. They feared it would trigger a wave of antisemitism and questions about their dual loyalty. They preferred philanthropy to nationalism. They wanted to send money to help poor Jews in Palestine, but they didn't want a Jewish state. Witzman and Brandeis had to wage a fierce internal political war to silence these critics so that they could present a unified front to President Wilson. Section 16, The Russian Collapse and the Bolshevik Response. The Petrograd Telegram. One of the most ironic chapters of this story is what happened in Russia. The British had issued the Balfour Declaration partly to keep Russia in the war. They thought the Jews would stop the Bolsheviks. But on November 7, 1917, just 5 days after the Balfour Letter was signed, Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky seized power in Petrograd. Trotsky was himself Jewish, but he was a staunch internationalist. He loathed Zionism. He saw it as a bourgeois imperialist trick. The Bolsheviks did something the British never expected: they opened the secret archives of the Tsar's Foreign Office. They found the secret Sykes-Picot agreement and published it in the newspapers. They wanted to show the world that the British and French were liars and imperialists. This was a disaster for Balfour. Suddenly, the Arabs realized that while the British were promising them independence, they had already signed a secret deal to carve up their land with the French. The Balfour Declaration was now seen not as a noble gesture, but as a mask for the Sykes-Picot betrayal. Section 17, The Arab Delegation, The View from Damascus. Prince Faisal and the Hopes of 1918. At the center of the Arab response was Prince Faisal, the son of the Sharif of Mecca. Faisal was the face of the Arab revolt. He was a tall, elegant man who had fought alongside T.E. Lawrence. In early 1918, Faisal was in a difficult position. He needed British support to build his Arab kingdom in Syria. He met with Chaim Witzman in a tent in the desert of Transjordan. The two men actually liked each other. They signed an agreement, the Faisal-Witzman Agreement, in which Faisal said he would support Jewish immigration to Palestine, provided the British gave the Arabs their independent kingdom in Syria. But the British never intended to give Faisal Syria. They had already promised it to the French. When the French eventually kicked Faisal out of Damascus, his deal with Witzman collapsed. The Arabs felt they had been lied to by everyone. They realized that the British had used the Zionists to check the French, and used the Arabs to check the Turks, and in the end, the only winner was the British Empire. The Balfour Declaration, Part 5. Section 18, 1919, The Hall of Mirrors and the New World Order. The Atmosphere of Paris. If 1917 was the year of the promise, 1919 was the year of the reckoning. The Great War was over. The German, Austro-Hungarian, and Ottoman empires had vanished into the ash heap of history. In January 1919, the world's leaders descended on Paris to design a new world. The city was a hive of frantic activity. Over 30,000 diplomats, lobbyists, and journalists crammed into the hotels. The Big Three, Lloyd George of Britain, George Clemenceau of France, and Woodrow Wilson of the United States held court in the gilded rooms of the Quai d'Orsay. Among them walked the ghosts of our story. Chaim Weizmann was there, heading the Zionist delegation. Prince Faisal was there, representing the Arab kingdom, draped in white silk robes and accompanied by T. E. Lawrence, who acted as his translator and shadow. The Zionist presentation. On February 27, 1919, the Zionist delegation was invited to address the Council of Ten. This was the moment Weizmann had spent his entire life preparing for. He didn't just present a political claim, he presented a historical case. He spoke of the 2,000 years of longing, the abnormal status of the Jewish people in Europe, and the unique ability of the Zionists to bring modern technology and agriculture to the neglected soil of Palestine. One of the most striking moments occurred when the American Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, asked Weizmann exactly what he meant by the term Jewish national home. Weizmann replied with a phrase that has echoed through history: "We want to make Palestine as Jewish as England is English or America is American." This was a bold escalation from the careful, ambiguous language of Balfour's letter. It signaled that the national home was not just a cultural center, but the blueprint for a sovereign state. Section 19. The Kinkrane Commission, the Ignored Warning. Woodrow Wilson's Moral Dilemma. President Woodrow Wilson was increasingly uncomfortable. He had championed the 14 points, one of which was the self-determination of peoples. He looked at the Middle East and saw the British and French carving it up like a Thanksgiving turkey. To salve his conscience, Wilson proposed a fact-finding mission. He sent two Americans, Henry King, a college president, and Charles Crane, a wealthy businessman, to the Middle East to actually ask the people living there what they wanted. The findings. For 6 weeks, King and Crane traveled through Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. They met with village elders, religious leaders, and merchants. Their report, known as the Kinkrane Commission, was a bombshell of honesty that the British and French tried to suppress for years. The report stated that the vast majority of the population, over 90%, was vehemently opposed to the Zionist project and to the French mandate. It warned that the Zionist program could only be carried out by force of arms. It stated, "There is no one thing upon which the population of the Near East are more agreed than their opposition to the entire Zionist program." King and Crane recommended that the scale of Jewish immigration be limited and that the national home be scaled back. But by the time the report reached Paris, Wilson had suffered a stroke, the American public was turning toward isolationism, and the British and French simply tucked the report into a drawer and ignored it. The self-determination of the Arabs was sacrificed at the altar of great power interests. Section 20, 1920, the San Remo Conference and the Mandate. The legalization of the promise. In April 1920, the victors met again in a small resort town on the Italian Riviera called San Remo. The purpose was to finalize the mandates. The mandate was a new colonial invention of the League of Nations. It wasn't supposed to be an annexation, it was supposed to be a sacred trust of civilization. A tutor country, Britain, would manage a pupil country, Palestine, until it was ready for independence. At San Remo, the Balfour Declaration was formally incorporated into the international legal framework. The British Mandate for Palestine was created, and its primary task, written into the preamble, was to put the Balfour Declaration into effect. This was the ultimate victory for Weizmann. The 6 to 7 words of a private letter had now become the international law of nations. The British now had a legal obligation to facilitate Jewish immigration and settlement. The first riots. While the diplomats drank champagne in San Remo, the first blood was spilled in Jerusalem. In April 1920, during the Nebi Musa festival, Arab frustrations boiled over into 3 days of rioting. Jewish shops were looted, lives were lost. This was a preview of the century. It showed that the double promise was not just a diplomatic headache, it was a physical impossibility. The British military administration in Palestine, headed by General Ronald Storrs, was caught in the middle. Many of the British officers on the ground actually sympathized with the Arabs. They saw the Balfour Declaration as a London-made disaster that they were forced to enforce with bayonets. Section 21. The Churchill White Paper of 1922. Winston's Balancing Act. By 1921, Winston Churchill had become the colonial secretary. He was the man responsible for making the mandate work. He travelled to Jerusalem and was met with furious Arab protests. He realized that the British could not simply ignore the Arab majority forever. To calm the situation, he issued the 1922 White Paper. This was the first reinterpretation of the Balfour Declaration. Churchill stated that the national home did not mean that all of Palestine would become a Jewish state. He also famously severed the land east of the Jordan River, Transjordan, and gave it to Prince Abdullah, Faisal's brother, to rule as an Arab emirate. This was the first partition of the land promised in the Balfour Declaration. It angered the Zionists, who felt the national home had been halved, and it failed to satisfy the Arabs, who still saw the core of Palestine being taken away. The Balfour Declaration, Part 6. Section 22, The Herbert Samuel Era, The Experiment Begins, 1920-1925. The First High Commissioner. In July 1920, a new figure arrived at the Jaffa port. Sir Herbert Samuel was appointed as the first High Commissioner of Palestine. This was a moment of profound symbolism. Samuel was an observant Jew, a former cabinet minister, and the man who had first suggested the idea of a Jewish homeland to the British government back in 1914. To the Zionists, his arrival was the return of the Nehemiah. To the Arabs, it was the final proof that the British were not neutral tutors but active agents of Zionism. Samuel arrived wearing a white diplomatic uniform and a pith helmet, walking through the narrow streets of Jerusalem to his headquarters at the Augusta Victoria complex on the Mount of Olives. He was a man of deep integrity, caught in an impossible position. He wanted to prove that a Jewish governor could be fair to Arabs, but his very presence was a provocation to the Arab leadership, led by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini. The Legislative Council Fiasco. Samuel's first major project was to create a legislative council where Arabs and Jews would sit together and help rule the land. It was a classic British parliamentary solution to a non-parliamentary problem. The Arabs refused to participate. They argued that by sitting in the council, they would be recognizing the legal validity of the Balfour Declaration. They demanded a government based on their 90% majority, not a council where the British held the tie-breaking vote. This boycott effectively paralyzed the civil administration for years, leaving the British to rule by decree, a benevolent autocracy that satisfied no one. Section 23, The 1929 Wailing Wall Riots, The Tipping Point. The Spark in the Holy City. For much of the 1920s, Palestine was relatively quiet. There was a period of false calm where the British thought they might actually pull off the Balfour Project. But in August 1929, the peace shattered. The flashpoint was the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, in Jerusalem. Tensions had been simmering over the right of Jews to bring chairs and screens to the wall for prayer. Rumors spread through the Arab community that the Zionists were planning to seize the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The result was an explosion of violence that changed the trajectory of the mandate. In Hebron, a Jewish community that had lived there for centuries, their old yishuv, was devastated in a brutal massacre. By the time the British brought in troops from Egypt to restore order, over 130 Jews and 110 Arabs were dead. The Shaw Commission and the Hollow Promise. The British government, now under a Labour administration, sent out the Shaw Commission to investigate. The report was a shock to London. It stated that the fundamental cause of the violence was the Arab feeling of disappointment of their political and national aspirations and fear for their economic future. For the first time, a British official body admitted that the Balfour Declaration's two halves, the Jewish home and the Arab rights, were in direct, violent conflict. Section 24, The Parsfield White Paper, 1930, The First Retreat. The Ghost of Sidney Webb. Following the Shaw Report, the Colonial Secretary, Lord Parsfield, the famous socialist Sidney Webb, issued a new policy. The Parsfield White Paper of 1930 was a devastating blow to the Zionists. It suggested that Jewish immigration should be severely curtailed and that land sales to Jews should be restricted to protect the Arab peasantry. Chaim Weizmann was incandescent with rage. He saw this as a betrayal of the Balfour Declaration. He resigned his position as president of the Zionist organization in protest. He used his immense political network to pressure the British government. In what became known as the Black Letter, Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald eventually wrote to Weizmann, effectively explaining away the white paper and reinstating the pro-Zionist policy. This flip-flop convinced the Arabs that they could never win through British commissions that London was owned by Zionist influence. Section 25, The 1930s and the Fifth Aliyah. The Rise of Hitler and the Great Shift. Everything changed in 1933. The rise of the Nazi Party in Germany turned the Zionist aspiration into an urgent, desperate necessity for survival. The Fifth Aliyah began a massive wave of Jewish immigration, mostly from Central Europe. Between 1932 and 1935, the Jewish population of Palestine doubled. This wasn't the rural, pioneering movement of the 1910s. This was an urban, professional, and wealthy influx. Cities like Tel Aviv exploded into Bauhaus-style metropolises. The national home was becoming a national reality. But as the Jewish population reached 30% of the total, the Arab population realized that if they didn't act soon, they would be a minority in their own land. The stage was set for the Great Arab Revolt. The Balfour Declaration, Part 7. Section 26, The Great Arab Revolt, 1936-1939. The Strike That Shook the Mandate. By 1936, the double promise of the Balfour Declaration had finally reached its breaking point. The Arab population, seeing the massive influx of Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany, realized that the national home was no longer a theoretical project, it was a demographic takeover. Under the leadership of the Arab High Committee, a general strike was called. It lasted 6 months, the longest in colonial history. Shops were shuttered, farms were abandoned, and the British administration was paralyzed. But the strike soon turned into an armed insurgency. Arab guerrillas, known as Mujahideen, took to the hills of Samaria and Galilee. They targeted British police stations, blew up oil pipelines, and attacked Jewish settlements. For the British, this was a nightmare. They had to pour 20,000 troops into Palestine, more than they had in all of India at the time. To suppress the revolt, the British used iron fist tactics, collective fines, the demolition of houses, and the execution of rebel leaders. The Balfour Declaration, once a romantic ideal of Arthur Balfour, was now being enforced by the barrel of a Lewis gun. The birth of the Haganah and the night squads. This period also saw the militarization of the Zionist movement. The Haganah, the secret Jewish defense force, grew from a collection of farm guards into a disciplined army. A British officer named Ord Wingate, an eccentric, Bible-quoting Christian Zionist, began training special night squads of Jewish soldiers to launch preemptive strikes on Arab villages. Among his students was a young Moshe Dayan. This was a pivotal shift. The Zionists realized that the British shield was no longer enough, they had to build their own sword to protect the promise of 1917. Section 27, The Peel Commission, The First Partition Plan, 1937. The Solomonic Solution. In 1937, the British government sent yet another commission, led by Lord Peel, to find a way out of the chaos. For the first time, a British official body admitted the truth that Balfour had ignored: the Arab and Jewish nationalisms were irreconcilable. The double promise was a lie. The Peel Commission recommended the Solomonic solution, partition. They proposed carving Palestine into three zones: a tiny Jewish state, about 20% of the land, a much larger Arab state merged with Jordan, and a permanent British corridor from Jaffa to Jerusalem. The reaction: yes, no, and never. The reaction was a microcosm of the entire conflict. Chaim Weizmann and David Ben-Gurion were torn. The proposed Jewish state was tiny, hardly more than a postage stamp, but it was a state. They argued that even a small state was a platform for future growth. The Arab leadership rejected it out of hand. They asked why they should give up 20% of their land to a population that had arrived mostly in the last 20 years. To them, partition was just a slower form of theft. The British public was horrified. They realized that the national home was going to require an endless war to maintain. Section 28, the 1939 White Paper, the death of the Balfour Policy. The shadow of the Second World War. As 1939 approached, the winds of war were blowing in Europe again. Nazi Germany was on the march. The British government, now led by Neville Chamberlain, faced a terrifying strategic calculation. If war broke out with Germany, Britain could not afford to have the entire Arab world in revolt. They needed the oil of Iraq, the base in Egypt, and the loyalty of the Muslim world. In May 1933, the British government issued the MacDonald White Paper. It was the ultimate U-turn. It stated that Jewish immigration would be limited to 75,000 people over the next 5 years. After 5 years, no more Jews could arrive without Arab consent. In 10 years, Palestine would become an independent state with an Arab majority. The betrayal of the promise. To the Zionists, this was the great betrayal. It was the literal death of the Balfour Declaration. At the very moment when the Jews of Europe were facing the Holocaust, the British were closing the doors to the only place of refuge. David Ben-Gurion famously said, "We will fight the white paper as if there is no war, and we will fight the war as if there is no white paper." The Balfour Declaration had come full circle. It began as a strategic tool to help Britain win one war, and it was being discarded to help Britain win another. The Balfour Declaration, Part 8. Section 29, The Holocaust and the Shift to America. The Moral Weight of 1945. As the Second World War ended and the horrors of the Nazi death camps were revealed to the world, the Balfour Declaration took on a new, terrible urgency. The hundreds of thousands of displaced persons in Europe had nowhere to go. The British, still clinging to the 1939 White Paper, refused to let them into Palestine. The struggle for the Balfour Promise shifted from London to New York and Washington. The Zionists realized that Great Britain was a spent force, an empire in bankruptcy. The new guarantor of the Jewish home would have to be the United States. President Harry Truman, moved by the plight of the refugees and pushed by a strong domestic Zionist lobby, began to pressure the British to allow 100,000 Jews into Palestine immediately. Section 30, The Insurgency Against the British, 1944-1947. The hunters become the hunted. The most ironic chapter of the mandate was the Jewish revolt against Britain. Radical groups like the Ergun, led by Menachem Begin, and the Lehi, the Stern Gang, began a campaign of terror against the British administration. They blew up bridges, kidnapped British officers, and in 1946, bombed the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, the headquarters of the British government, killing 91 people. The British soldiers, who had fought to liberate the Jews from the Nazis, now found themselves being hunted by Jewish guerrillas in the streets of Tel Aviv. The British public had had enough. The cost of maintaining the Balfour Promise was too high. Section 31, 1947, The British Exit and the UN Partition. The Final Act of the Empire. In February 1947, the British government announced they were returning the mandate to the United Nations. They were washing their hands of the whole affair. On November 29, 1947, the UN voted on Resolution 181, which proposed the partition of Palestine into an Arab and a Jewish state, with Jerusalem as an international city. 30 years after Arthur Balfour sent his 6-to-7-word letter, the British Empire packed its bags. As the last British soldiers lowered the Union Jack in Haifa on May 14, 1948, the State of Israel was proclaimed. The national home was finally a reality, but it was born in the midst of a war with five Arab armies, a war that would never truly end. Section 32, Epilogue, The Ghost of Arthur Balfour. The Legacy of 6-to-7 Words. Arthur Balfour died in 1930. On his deathbed, He was asked what he considered his greatest achievement. He didn't say his time as Prime Minister, he didn't say his philosophical works. He said it was the Balfour Declaration. To Balfour, it was a great experiment in righting a historical wrong. To the Zionists, it was the Magna Carta of their liberation. To the Arabs, it was the original sin of Western colonialism, a document written by a man who never visited the land, promising away the homes of a people who were never consulted. As you reflect on this today, look at the map of the world. The borders, the walls, and the headlines of the Middle East are still the echoes of that 6-7-word letter. It is a reminder that in the world of empires, a few lines of ink can create a century of blood. The Balfour Declaration, Part 9, The Appendices. Section 33, The Aftermath, Whatever Happened to the Key Players? Arthur James Balfour, The Stoic to the End. Balfour remained a titan of British politics until the very end. After 1917, he served as the principal British delegate to the Versailles Peace Conference and later played a massive role in the Washington Naval Treaty. He was eventually elevated to an earldom. Despite the chaos his declaration caused, he never publicly expressed regret. In 1925, he actually visited Palestine to open the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He was met with cheering crowds of Jews and black flag protests from the Arabs. He died in 1930 at the age of 81. In his final days, he was seen reading a volume of Hebrew poetry. He saw himself as a restorer, a man who had helped the people of the book return to the land of the book. Chaim Weizmann, the Scientist King. Weizmann's path was perhaps the most triumphant and the most tragic. He spent the 1930s and 40s in a constant, exhausting battle with the British government over the 1939 White Paper. He felt personally betrayed by the men he had once considered friends. When the State of Israel was declared in 1948, Weizmann was elected its first president. However, the role was largely ceremonial. The old lion of Zionism found himself sidelined by the younger, more militant David Ben-Gurion. He died in 1952, a man who had seen his chemical formula save an empire, and his political formula create a nation. Edwin Montagu, the man without a country. Montagu's end was the most somber. After the Balfour Declaration was issued, his political career slowly withered. He felt like an outcast within his own community and a dinosaur within the cabinet. He left politics in 1922 and died just 2 years later at the age of 45. His warnings about dual loyalty and the unresolvable conflict in Palestine became the haunting subtext of the 20th century Jewish experience in the diaspora. Section 34. The original text, a deep philological reading. To round out our analysis, we should listen to the actual text of the letter one more time, but this time, we will stop at every phrase to understand why it was chosen. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations which has been submitted to, and approved by, the Cabinet. His Majesty's government. This signaled that this was not just Balfour's opinion. It was the policy of the king. Sympathy, this is a weak word. The Zionists wanted recognition, but the British gave sympathy. It was a classic diplomatic out in case they wanted to back down later. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. View with favor, again, not a guarantee, but an expression of support. National home, this was a brand new term in international law. It didn't mean state. It was deliberately vague. It could mean a cultural center, a province, or a country. In Palestine, as we noted earlier, this meant the home would be inside Palestine, not that all of Palestine would be the home. And will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Best endeavors, a legal term that essentially means we will try, but we won't promise success. Existing non-Jewish communities, this is the most controversial phrase. At the time, Arabs made up 90% of the population, yet they were defined by what they were not, non-Jewish. Their political rights were not mentioned, only their civil and religious rights. This signaled that the British saw them as a religious minority in a land they actually owned, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. This was the Montagu Clause. It was added to ensure that a Jew in London wouldn't lose their British citizenship just because a Jewish home existed in Jerusalem. Section 35. The Long Shadow, Memory and Myth. The Balfour Day Commemorations. For decades, November 2nd was a day of celebration in Jewish communities and a day of mourning and strikes in Arab communities. It was known as Balfour Day. In the 1920s, Jewish schools in Tel Aviv would have parades. In Nablus and Jaffa, Arab shops would close their doors and black flags would fly from the minarets. Even today, on the centenary of the declaration in 2017, the British government faced demands from the Palestinian Authority to apologize for the letter. The British government refused, stating that they were proud of their role in creating the State of Israel, while also acknowledging that the second half of the declaration, the rights of the Arabs, remained unfulfilled. Section 36. Final Reflections, The Lesson of 1917. The lesson of the Balfour Declaration is one of the law of unintended consequences. The British thought they were being clever. They thought they could use the Zionists to protect the canal, use the Arabs to beat the Turks, and use the French to win the war. They thought they could manage the world with a few well-placed prepositions and a 6-to-7-word letter. But they forgot that people are not pawns on a chessboard. The national home and the Arab independence were not just lines on a map, they were the deepest, most sacred aspirations of two different peoples. By promising the same land to both, the British created a zero-sum game that continues to this day. The Balfour Declaration reminds us that history is not made by inevitability. It is made by specific men in specific rooms, driven by their own prejudices, their own scientific discoveries, and their own imperial anxieties. Arthur Balfour, Chaim Weizmann, and Edwin Montague are long gone, but we still live in the world they built in the autumn of 1917.